Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Thursday, April the 11th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the assassination of three sons and several grandsons of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. Sudan's military leaders want to exclude adversaries from any future governmental structure. Sudan's drone hits border areas around the country, and thousands are still fleeing Sudan amid ongoing conflict. In the second and third hours, we listened to a panel discussion on the situation in Palestine. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the East African state of Tanzania with the band entitled Marquise Original, Super Sandema. Let's listen in.
Oh, Thank you. Se vengo a la semana, yo me sikukosea ni mi baba. Nisemengo sasa ni mwaka wa tano. Hakumuki hata sisi wazazi wako we. Nisemengo ebu rejea nyumbani. Nisemengo, nisemengo, nisemengo.
Wakati nilikuwa nikiishi peke yangu, wenzangu walinicheka.
kuanza choko choko na maneno mengi. Wakati nilikuwa nikiishi peke yangu, wenzangu wananiita nisilete kwamba siolewi, nitatele wana nyumba.
Thank you. Thank you.
music from the East African state of Tanzania, from the band Original Super Sandema. And that is Pan-African classic music from the United Republic of Tanzania in East Africa. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for this Thursday, April 11th, 2024. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Ongoing shock and, of course, outrage is following an Israeli airstrike which targeted the car used by Ismail Haniyeh's sons, killing them and their children on Eid al-Fitr as they were visiting relatives. Three sons of the head of Hamas's political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, were killed in an Israeli strike on a car in the western part of the al-Shakti refugee camp in Gaza City, sources told al-Mahdeen yesterday. On the day of Eid al-Fitr, a holiday celebrated by the Muslim community as it marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan, the Israeli occupation committed yet another malicious act, killing Hassim, Amir, and Mohammed, the sons of Ismail Haniyeh, and several of his grandchildren. The children killed in the attack were Amal, Khalid, and Rasan. Haniyeh, who is currently leading Hamas's political bureau from Qatar's capital, Doha, received the news from his assistant with impeccable resilience. The resistance leader was seen on camera during a hospital visit he had planned on Wednesday to check up on wounded and sick Palestinians that were transferred to a medical center in Doha. Haniyeh, which God's blessing on his three martyred sons and their children, insisting he would finish his day's program at the hospital. The government's media office in Gaza said that the Israelis' occupation committed the massacre while the three were conducted Eid al-Fitr visits to communities in the Gaza Strip. On the day of the Eid, 125 Palestinians were murdered by Israeli forces, and that has occurred between Tuesday afternoon and yesterday. Commenting on the devastating incident, Haniyeh was quoted by Hamas's media office as saying, "With this pain and blood, we create hope, a future, and freedom for our people, our cause, and our nation. My sons, the martyrs, achieved the greatest honor and an honorable death," he explained. "My sons' remains with the sons of our people in the Gaza Strip, as they did not leave the Strip," Haniyeh emphasized. "All of our people and every family in the Gaza Strip paid a steep price toward the Palestinian struggle with the blood of their children, and I am one of them. Nearly 60 of my relatives were martyred. There is no difference between them and other Palestinians," the head of the Hamas political bureau added. "Israel will fail to break the will of our people." In other news on the African continent, Sudanese military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said on Wednesday that those who did not support Sudan during the current conflict with an armed opposition group will have no role in the country's future leadership. Addressing worshippers at a Jedaref mosque, al-Burhan stressed that the state will only be run by those who have withstood the injustice and violations, unquote. He stated that there would be no discussion about the return of democratic rule until the conflict ended. He said the conflict had exposed who truly supported Sudan, both domestically and internationally. The military leader performed Eid al-Fitr prayers in Shajara, Jedaref, following a recent drone attack on the city. Al-Burhan's remarks suggest the military's continued opposition to including civilian forces from the previous transitional government. They had previously proposed a technocratic government to be followed by elections. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, we go back to Sudan. Exclusive information obtained by the Sudan Tribune revealed the identity of the drones that targeted military sites in the Jedaref on Tuesday. A security source confirmed that the suicide drones were Chinese-made and were an imitation of the Iranian Shahed 136 planes. These are unmanned aerial vehicles are pre-programmed with the target coordinates without cameras on them. Information indicates that these UAVs have a flight range of approximately 1,500 kilometers and can fly for more than 6 hours at speeds up to 180 kilometers per hour, which makes it possible to launch them from long distances. These drones fly at a relatively low altitude, which may reach a maximum of 1,500 meters, and attack their targets from a height ranging between 100 and 700 meters. These Chinese drones contain communication devices, but they are not necessarily for their operation, which reduces the effectiveness of jamming devices against them. However, it can be shot down by jamming the GPS, according to the security source. Several days ago, a similar suicide drone hit a building where the Sudanese Islamist militants who might alongside the army were gathered, but no group responsibility for the attacks. And finally, another report dealing with the current situation on the continent in Sudan. More than 10 million children in the country have been in an active war zone and less than 5 kilometers away from gunfire, shelling, and other deadly violence over the past year of war, said Save the Children. Analysis by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project on behalf of the charity found that 1 in 2 children in Sudan are currently or have been within 5 kilometers of the front lines of the conflict. This is a 60% increase from the already 6.6 million children exposed to violence in the first month of the fighting and shows how the conflict has continued to increase in scale and in scope across the country. You can read these articles in their entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. That's going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to this edition of the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast, a special edition of our program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Rotary Connection out of Chicago with the track entitled Life Could, featuring Minnie Riperton and Sidney Barnes from the late 1960s. And Palestine, of course, the struggle continues. Yesterday it was 187 days. We're going to feature the electronic Intifada update report, one of the primary sources on the situation in Palestine. Let's listen in.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, April 10th. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 187 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including a discussion with journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein about Israel's use of tech, surveillance, and artificial intelligence during the past 6 months of its genocide in Gaza. And later on in the program, of course, a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian Armed Resistance with John Elmer, including detailed analysis of the complex resistance ambush that chased the Israeli military from Khan Yunus and Hezbollah's downing of Israel's flagship drone over Lebanon. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. Palestinians across the Gaza Strip gathered to mark the end of Ramadan today on Eid al-Fitr. In Jabalia refugee camp, where every single one of the mosques have been destroyed by Israel over the last 6 months, Palestinians recited the Eid prayers outside in the pouring rain. The Israeli army withdrew most of its ground forces from the southern Gaza Strip over the weekend, but Israeli airstrikes have not stopped across Gaza. On Monday and Tuesday, Israel bombed areas in Deir al-Balah and Maghazi and Nuseirat refugee camps. Hatem al-Gamri, the mayor of Maghazi, was killed in an Israeli airstrike on the camp. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that since October 7th, approximately 34,000 Palestinians have been killed and 76,000 injured, with many thousands more missing or buried under the rubble. Earlier today, Israel targeted and killed three sons and grandchildren of Hamas Politburo chief Ismail Haniyeh in an airstrike on their car near Shati refugee camp. In Khan Yunus, after the Israeli army withdrew, activist and journalist Maha Husseini tweeted that, quote, not a single home isn't bombed, not one building isn't scorched. Walking through the neighborhoods, you cannot help but sense Israel's palpable desire for revenge against an entire population. Palestine Red Crescent Society staff were able to survey the damage Israeli forces had inflicted on Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunus, the medical organization's headquarters, after Israel's 43-day siege forced the hospital to suspend all services on March 26th. The Palestine Red Crescent reported that Israeli occupation forces destroyed PRCS vehicles, including ambulances, that were parked in front of Al-Amal Hospital before the soldiers withdrew from the area. They also stated that, quote, after the withdrawal of Israeli occupation forces from the vicinity of Palestine Red Crescent Society Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunus on April 7th, the extent of the significant damage to the hospital's facilities became evident. The occupation forces raided the hospital, resulting in the destruction of medical equipment, nursing rooms, intensive care units, the ophthalmology department, the emergency operations room, and ambulances. During the Israeli siege on the Al-Amal Hospital, Palestine Red Crescent Society staff said that one of their colleagues, a nurse named Mohammed Abed, was fired on by Israeli soldiers when evacuating medical teams and patients. For about 2 weeks, quote, his fate remained unknown as the ambulance crew was prevented from transporting him. Mohammed Abed's body was found on Sunday, quote, identified through the uniform of the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which was supposed to provide him with protection. They said that Mohammed was dedicated to his work, continuing to provide medical services to patients and the wounded despite the hospital siege, which lasted 43 days. Rest in peace, Mohammed, the Palestine Red Crescent Society stated. With Mohammed's killing, the Red Crescent added, the number of their personnel killed by Israeli forces in Gaza while performing their humanitarian duties has risen to 16. Over the weekend, Palestinian civil defense crews began retrieving bodies and body parts from the grounds in and around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, following the two-week slaughter carried out by Israeli forces before they withdrew last week. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported that forensic, ambulance, and civil defense crews uncovered bodies from pits dug by the Israeli army in the hospital courtyard. Gaza's civil defense says that more than 400 bodies have been recovered since the Israeli army's retreat. Motassem Salah, director of the Gaza Emergency Operations Center, told Agence France-Presse that, quote, the stench of death is everywhere as a bulldozer went through the rubble and rescue workers pulled decomposed bodies from the sand and ruins. Speaking to the AFP agency, Salah said that Gaza lacked the forensic experts needed to help identify the dead or determine what had happened to them. So they are relying on the expertise of delegations with the World Health Organization and the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. They are trying, quote, to identify the decomposed bodies and the body parts that were crushed from wallets and documents, he told AFP. Salah added that the psychological impact of this unwatchable process on the families is unbearable, AFP reported. The United Nations stated that, quote, following six attempts to reach Al-Shifa Hospital that were either denied, delayed, or impeded by Israeli authorities during the two-week assault, the World Health Organization reported that the scale of devastation has left what was once the largest and most important referral hospital in Gaza completely non-functional, with substantial efforts needed to clear unexploded ordnance, assess the potential for making the facility safe and accessible, and evaluate the functionality of vital equipment such as ventilators and CT scanners. Most hospital buildings, including the emergency department, the surgical and maternity ward buildings, and the neonatal intensive care department, were extensively damaged or burnt, along with most of the equipment, beds, incubators, the oxygen plant, and other assets. As a result, according to the World Health Organization, northern Gaza has been left without any CT scanning capabilities, significantly reduced laboratory capacity, and only one source for medical oxygen production at Kamal Adwan Hospital, quote, severely compromising effective diagnosis, which will increase avoidable deaths. COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of Israel's occupation, boasted this week that it had increased the number of international humanitarian aid trucks being allowed to enter Gaza and announced that it had opened both the Ashdod port and the Erez crossing in northern Gaza for humanitarian aid deliveries. The announcement came after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden spoke on the phone following Israel's drone strike on the World Central Kitchen workers last week. However, the United Nations confirmed on Tuesday that the Erez crossing, quote, remains closed, contrary to what Israel promised 4 days ago. Erez crossing and the Ashdod port are still not operational, despite what was announced, the UN added. Quote, at the moment, Israel only allows trucks to pass through Rafah and to a lesser extent through Kerem Shalom, both in the south. The spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs explained why the truck entry figures reported by the Israeli government differ from those reported by the UN. Israel counts the trucks it inspects and lets in, and the UN counts those that arrive at its warehouses. Between these two steps, the spokesperson said, there are problems. First, the trucks entering are half loaded, a requirement Israel has imposed. They then force Egyptian drivers to unload and leave before Palestinian trucks and drivers can pick up the cargo, something that often does not happen until the next day and makes it impossible to compare day-to-day figures. UN trucks are loaded and accounted for as fully loaded, the UN stated. Some of the humanitarian aid trucks that are making it into the Gaza Strip are carrying much-needed medications and medical supplies to partially functioning hospitals or medical clinics and field hospitals. But physicians say that the medicine and food is only a drop in the bucket compared to what is really needed to address Israel's engineered crisis of starvation and bodily harm due to 6 months of this genocide. This is Wissam El-Sekni, media director at Kamel Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, speaking to Al Jazeera on Monday.
Shipment of medicines yesterday is not enough compared to the urgent needs of citizens due to the high rates of malnutrition among them, along with the shortage of some food and medicines for these children, whom you can see in the background behind me in the children's nursery. Most of the children come into the hospital with malnutrition, especially premature babies, due to the malnutrition of the mother, and that affects the mother and other patients.
I'm not only suffering because of her, but also because of all the children. Every child is suffering from malnutrition, and every day we lose 5 or 10 children.
That was Wissam El-Sekni of Kamel Adwan Hospital speaking to Al Jazeera. Legendary Palestinian activist, poet and novelist Walid Dakka died in an Israeli prison this week after Israeli authorities refused to release him after he completed his 37-year sentence and was battling myelofibrosis, a rare form of bone marrow cancer. Dakka, who was 62, was born in the Palestinian city of Baqa' al-Gharbiya in present-day Israel, where he was a citizen. He was arrested by Israeli occupation forces in March of 1986 for allegedly participating in armed resistance as a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party. Israeli authorities sentenced him with a maximum imprisonment term of 37 years. As of 2023, Dakka completed that sentence. But in 2017, Israel extended his detention by two years on the grounds that he had smuggled phones into his cell with the assistance of a lawmaker from the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Admir, the Palestinian prisoners' rights group, said last year that Dakka was, quote, in dire need of urgent medical attention. The Israeli prison service doctor assigned to treat Dakka prescribed medications that severely compromised his immune system and increased his risk of infections. Admir called for his immediate release from prison, but Israel refused and ordered his release date for 2025. Particularly cruel is the Israeli prison service's policy of refusing to give Dakka's body to his grieving family, withholding his body until his 2025 sentence is over. Last year, my colleague Tamara Nassar wrote that, quote, Dakka, who spent the majority of his life in Israeli prison, authored multiple books while incarcerated, including a children's book on the Israeli occupation of Palestine titled The Oil's Secret Tale. Israeli prison authorities punished him for it, placing him in solitary confinement. In 1999, Dakka married his wife Sana Salama from prison, and in 2020, the couple had a daughter, Milad, who was conceived with sperm smuggled from prison. On Monday, the Israeli police raided Walid Dakka's home and the condolences tent, assaulted his family, arrested several mourners, and confiscated the tent. Admir stated on Monday that, quote, today Dakka departs, leaving behind the message he wrote in his 36th year inside the occupation's prisons, saying, I will continue to love you all, for love is my humble and sole victory over my jailer. And finally, protesters are continuing to loudly shame U.S. political cheerleaders of Israel's genocide wherever they go. In New York City, protesters disrupted an event this week featuring accomplished war hawk Hillary Clinton.
It's the national story, or stories. That we need to tell now.
Students at Arizona State University this week confronted blood-soaked Democratic Party elites David Axelrod and Nancy Pelosi.
Pelosi, you are complicit in genocide. The blood of over 15,000 Palestinian babies is on your hands. How can you be a Democrat and say you hold democratic values while over 100,000 innocent Palestinian civilians have been massacred with bombs that you paid for? We will not be shamed into voting for you or Genocide Joe and your massacrist policy. My family back home in Palestine is being killed. Their blood is on your hands. And David Axelrod, shame on you and every one of the Democratic elites that wants to shame us for voting for Genocide Joe. 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire. Shame on you. Shame on you.
And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine and across the world over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our crucial new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abu Nima. Coming up, we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza. But first, Ali, I know you wanted to send some special Eid greetings.
Yeah, I want to say Eid Mubarak, kul amu intu b'khair to everyone who's observing Eid today and in the coming days. We received many lovely messages from readers and viewers. And this morning I spent some time sending and receiving Eid messages on WhatsApp from many of our contributors and friends in Gaza. And it was very moving that they are unbowed. They're going through terrible days, and many of their wishes were for better days in the future that we hope and pray will come. But I just want to say here to all our friends and loved ones and colleagues in Gaza, kul amu intu b'khair. We hope and pray that next year will be, the next Eid will be an Eid of celebration, of healing, of togetherness, of justice, and victory.
Yeah, exactly. Eid Mubarak. Well, before we go to John, Ali and I interviewed journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein about Israel's use of surveillance technology and artificial intelligence during its genocidal attacks on Gaza. This was pre-recorded because of the time difference in Australia, but let's go to that interview. Barrows Friedman with Ali Abu Nima. We wanted to dive into the topic of Israeli weaponry and specifically the use of artificial intelligence and facial recognition technology being used by Israel's genocidal army and sold by Israel on the market to other states.
Our colleague Michael Brown wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about the Israeli military's use of facial recognition to collect information about Palestinians in Gaza using tech from CoreSight, a private Israeli company. Michael writes that, quote, Israel's apartheid army detained, interrogated, and beat Palestinian poet Mus'ab Abu Toha, a graduate of Syracuse University, with the assistance of CoreSight's facial recognition technology. Other Palestinians have been similarly detained via CoreSight technology. Joining us to talk about this is Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony is a journalist and the author, most recently, of The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Anthony joined us on the Electronic Intifada podcast last year to talk about his book, and we're so pleased to have him back with us today. Welcome, Anthony.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be back.
Thanks. Let's begin by having you talk about CoreSight, a company that Israel is currently helping battle test its products in Gaza. You've written about CoreSight in your book, The Palestine Laboratory, and you lay out how this company is, or rather lay out for us how this company is operating during the genocide that's going on in Gaza right now.
Just briefly, so CoreSight's been around for a number of years, and in the past it's worked in facial recognition with brutal police forces from Brazil and elsewhere. And as I talk about in my book, the company has also worked with various companies and individuals in the occupied West Bank to, inverted commas, perfect that technology on Palestinians. The focus then was more the West Bank. Now, fast forward, obviously, to after October 7, and both what I was hearing and reporting, but also there was that New York Times story a few weeks ago, which I guess confirmed it, although I'd heard this before that story came out, that CoreSight was working with the Israeli military alongside, I might add, Google Photos. Now, the role of Google in Israel, along with Amazon, many viewers will be aware of this, have been assisting with the Israeli military with cloud services for a number of years, and it's been a long campaign by staff of both companies to try to stop that. But what we know now is, and I'm sure viewers have seen this as well, you know, since October 7, there's often been footage and that's emerged from Gaza, which shows long lines of Palestinians walking from A to B, essentially being forcibly moved, ethnically cleansed from part of the Gaza Strip to somewhere else. And often you would see this almost sort of on stilts, this sort of camera, which we always presume was some kind of facial recognition technology, which it clearly was, almost certainly owned by CoreSight. And what they're essentially doing, I mean, the Israelis claim, nonsense, but what they claim is trying to find Hamas militants, the argument being that people are moving from point A to point B. How do we know who's in that population? Maybe there are Hamas terrorists, so they claim, amongst that population. But essentially what's happening is that huge numbers of people's details are being collected. Their data is being collected. There's no consent. And people often are being taken in and arrested and tortured by Israel, both within Gaza and in Israeli prisons, based on what? False information, misidentification. And this is what I've been hearing for a number of months, and this New York Times piece almost, I guess, consolidated that information. But it's an interesting case where I've already seen examples of CoreSight since October 7, this is before this New York Times story appeared, potentially promoting itself globally as battle-tested, showing that how effective, again, their words, it is in Gaza, and therefore trying to sell that to particularly police forces around the world. And I'd have to say that history would suggest a number of police forces, both in democracies and dictatorships, would find that very attractive.
And Anthony, you know, you use that term battle-tested. It's well known that not just CoreSight, but many, many Israeli weapons companies, like, for example, Elbit Systems, which is the biggest or one of the two biggest in Israel, market their technologies as battle-tested and battle-proven, which means tested on Palestinians and tested by murdering Palestinians. If not in this current genocide, I'm sure that's going on now, but many of the weapons that have been sold around the world would have been tested during the previous massacres Israel has carried out in Gaza, for example, in 2014. Mm. And we know that weapons, intelligence, surveillance are huge exports for Israel, and various regimes around the world, so-called democracies, as well as others, have been buying these technologies on the basis that Israel is considered to be this country with tremendous technology, tremendous prowess, tremendous capability. And that's been one of Israel's real marketing points. But what we saw on October 7th was this myth being completely imploded by the resistance, which carried out a very sophisticated, very well-planned attack all along the Gaza boundary, completely defeating this $1.5 billion high-tech fence, effectively blinding the Israeli electronic surveillance and completely collapsing and routing the Israeli military's Gaza division. So was it all PR and marketing, and can Israel recover that reputation, or is it just damaged goods, so to speak?
I would agree with everything you've just said, but there's one important caveat. And the caveat is that although so far, obviously we're, I'd say, only 6 months in since October 7, there's been no real accountability in any way within Israel for what happened, suffice to say. And I've been seeing lots of evidence that, in fact, the companies, including Israeli companies, including some of which were whose technology or so-called defences were breached on October 7, are still promoting and marketing and testing in Gaza new technology since October 7. So let me give you a couple of examples. So there's been two major global arms fairs since October 7, one in Paris late last year and one in Singapore in the last couple of months. And in both cases, a lot of Israeli defense companies, Elbit and others, were there promoting certain technology, certain tools, certain drones, certain killer quadcopters, various things that have been used, not on October 7, of course, but in Gaza since, as battle tested. I mean, they openly say so. The question I've been getting a lot in the last months is, doesn't October 7 show what Hamas did, that all this is smoke and mirrors? I mean, on one level, the answer is yes. But on the other hand, I would suggest, based on past history, that in fact, there is little evidence to suggest that Israel will not successfully market and sell huge amounts of tech they've been using in Gaza to make massive amounts of money. For example, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, which obviously is 2 years ago now, there was, as you guys have reported and I've covered as well, huge amounts of European states buying Israeli missile defense shields and other sort of things. I see no indication, zero, that has changed since October 7. Zero. European states are still interested in buying that tech. In their worldview, Russia is obviously still in Ukraine, which it is, and that conflict is unresolved. It's like a stalemate, really. So I would argue that all those European states that have been relying and wanting on Israeli tech will continue. And secondly, briefly, I think you will see, and I've said this for a number of months, the reason why much of the Arab elite's leadership I'm talking about here have not cut formal ties with Israel. Yes, they've expressed concern and they're disappointed, all that sort of thing. I think Israeli weapons and surveillance tech is a massive part of that, a huge part of that. What I mean by that is that the last figures we have for Israel's arms industry is 2022. We should get the 2023 figures soon. I mean, this is the official figures, which are always massaged, but we haven't got the 2023 figures. We should get them in the next couple of months. 24% of the 2022 figures were Arab autocracies, a quarter. And I see no indication that any of those Arab states will be less interested in repressive tech from Israel. In fact, I would argue they want them even more, because you've seen in the last 6 months huge amounts of Arabs on the streets protesting really their own governments in action or complicity in what Israel's doing in Gaza. So I would argue those states, their elites, are even more petrified of their own people. I mean, this to me is the underlying issue, that Arab elites are petrified of the Arab Spring Mark II. I mean, the Arab Spring was, you could argue, didn't succeed as many advocates would have wanted for obvious reasons. But the fact is that those Arab states want that sophisticated repressive tech that Israel sells and markets and is using in Gaza. So, yes, it's possible that October 7 and the complete Israeli failure on that day should negatively impact its arms industry, but honestly, I haven't seen much evidence of that so far.
Wow.
So far. Yeah. And obviously, there's always that caveat, so far. And I guess we'll talk about this just briefly, so just to continue, sorry, Nora, is that,
no.
And what Israel, of course, has been doing in the last 6 months is almost trying to make everyone forget about October 7. I don't mean rhetorically, obviously Israel has been using October 7 as a mantra 24/7. I mean what they're doing in Gaza with weapons and surveillance tech, facial recognition technology I don't think Israel's been using sophisticated drones simply as a marketing tool. They're using it in their way, so they argue, to fight Hamas. We can accept that or not, fine. But the marketing and selling of it is still a key factor. There's no doubt about that. And Israel's economy, as you guys would be aware, has taken a hit, as you'd expect, after 6 months of war. And even more reason why the Israeli state, I mean, you just probably saw in the last 24 hours, it's worth saying, Naftali Bennett, the unbelievably right-wing racist former prime minister who has aspirations to be prime minister again, put out this long tweet, which I think is worth reading, and I'll paraphrase. It's worth people to look at this. Essentially, he says, and I think this summarizes a lot of the thinking that I'm hearing in the Israeli defense and high-tech sector. He says essentially that Israel needs to become a Silicon Valley Sparta. That's his words, not mine. October 7 was a disaster. Again, I'm paraphrasing him. October 7 was a disaster for us. We were caught asleep. Hamas essentially overtook us. We were weak. What we need to do now is gather ourselves and become a global leader again and become a Silicon Valley Sparta. Now, it's pretty obvious what that means. And I think there are a lot of people in the Israeli political and defense sector who would share that view and will attempt to enact that. I guess we'll see how successful that is. But I think that thinking that he expresses is actually pretty common.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see in the months and years ahead how realistic that is, given that already prior to October 7th and the genocide, there was a major brain drain and capital flight from Israel. Israel markets itself as this Silicon Wadi, as they call it. But often any successful Israeli startup would quickly leave the country and the talent too. So we'll see how realistic.
I guess it depends on that front how strong a pull patriotism is, so-called patriotism, right? That the idea that a lot of what I'm hearing from certain people I'm speaking to in the Israeli defense or tech sector is that, and this is not everybody, but a number of people feel almost a patriotic duty to stay in Israel, I mean, and market and sell those tools to help the Israeli economy. Now, is that enough people? Who knows? But some will.
Yeah. Well, speaking of some of those weapons, just as someone who researches this and has been for years, thinking about the CoreSight facial recognition cameras, I mean, in the first couple months of the genocide, I remember there were stories of, when they were dividing the north of Gaza from the south, they set up a massive checkpoint and forced Palestinians who were fleeing the north to move through these containers that had facial recognition scanners attached to them. So we have that. It's unclear whether that was specifically CoreSight or a different surveillance tech company, or these armed quadcopter drones that we're seeing. I mean, during the siege on Al-Shifa Hospital, during the siege on Al-Amal Hospital, during the siege on Nasser Hospital, we saw these quadcopter drones not just armed and shooting patients and doctors and medical staff and aid workers inside the hospitals, but also they were outfitted with obviously cameras and loudspeakers so that the Israeli drone operator, wherever they were, either somewhere close by in a tank or in Tel Aviv or wherever, could use the loudspeaker as well. I mean, what kinds of weapons have we seen during this genocide that are now being marketed to other states? What's specific about the last 6 months that that you've really taken notice of in terms of the kinds of weapons here?
There's been a handful that have really struck out to me. And yes, there's obviously been drones that have been used by Israel and the US for decades and other states, but particularly since October 7, there's been a real expansion of the kinds of drones that Israel's been using. Some of them have existed before October 7. They didn't suddenly get designed on October 8, but they're being put into use, into battle, essentially. Some of these, again, there's been a form of suicide drones that existed for years. Israel has marketed and tested those for a number of years. But there's been interesting new forms of a form of suicide drone. They don't call it that, but that's essentially what it is. The quadcopter is a good example of that, Nora, because for years, they document in the book, in the West Bank for Palestinians, and indeed often when certain Israeli leftists have been protesting in the West Bank, they've had Israeli drones above them issuing instructions, you know, leave the area immediately. Now, obviously, Israeli Jews in the West Bank are normally not killed by drone. There have been exceptions, not by drone, but obviously Israelis can be killed. Where Palestinians, of course, as we know in Jenin and elsewhere, often are killed by drone. Although I think that inevitably is going to start changing. I mean, the idea that somehow Israeli Jews are protected, so to speak, within Israel or Palestine, which was generally the case for years. Of course, there are exceptions. There's been Israelis who have been killed and injured, of course. But in general, I think that'll change, where there is quite clearly a growing war on Israeli leftists, but then that's a slightly separate issue. The one I think that stands out the most to me is AI, AI-enabled warfare. And I wrote in my book that AI has been used by Israel in Gaza for a number of years. It's massively exploded in this war, and I'm sure you guys have talked about and you've seen a couple of reports that have come out in the last months by in 972 magazine, which the people I'm speaking to have roughly backed up that reporting.
But Anthony, if you, we've seen the reports, and I'm sure a lot of our viewers have. But can you just explain very in very simple terms what it is? Yeah.
Essentially, what these tools that they're using, they being Israel, they call names like Lavender, The Gospel, Where's Daddy? I mean, where do you even begin with those sort of titles? Essentially, they are gathering massive amounts of data. This data is coming from either human intelligence Israel has gained over the years, pre-October 7 and since. U.S. intelligence has, as you may recall, soon after October 7, had warships just off Israel, intelligence gathering from there. I've also done reporting through Declassified Australia, the site that I have, at Pine Gap, which is a major U.S. military base in the center of Australia. You could not be further away from the Middle East than there. The U.S. is gathering massive amounts of intelligence from that military base and sending it to Israel. So Israel is gathering all this intelligence, so-called intelligence. And what those reports essentially said was that the aim was to, so they claim, go after Hamas operatives, regardless of how low level they may be. Now, the impact of that decision, though, was that if there was going to be a, inverted commas, Hamas operative killed, it did not matter if there were dozens and dozens and dozens of Palestinian civilians killed at the same time. And this is also what I'm hearing as well. And there's one key line that comes up in that report, which is, an Israeli intelligence official says that our aim was revenge. Now, obviously, a blind person could see what's been happening in Gaza is based on that. But the decision to target a building, a home, in most of those cases, particularly in the first 3 months of 2023, had very little to no human oversight. In other words, the system is gathering all this intelligence, again, so-called intelligence, all this information, and it's pumping out tens of thousands of targets. This home, this building, this mosque, this school. And it's worth saying, although maybe obvious to the to viewers who are watching this, that how Israel defines a Hamas operative is pretty problematic, to put it mildly.
Well, it's pretty loose, I think.
Loose, to put it fresh. That's
so,
the polite way.
Just to create an analogy that I've heard someone else make, I don't claim an original authorship over this, but, you know, if you think about Hamas is a major political organization, it's dominant in Gaza, so literally everyone knows somebody who is connected in some way with Hamas, and that connection, the person who's connected to Hamas may not be connected at all to their military wing.
Absolutely.
They may be connected to the, to a social service agency or to any kind of social institution. But anyone with any connection with Hamas or with that person, whether they're a family member, a friend, a neighbor, someone who provides a service to them, could be considered fair game by this AI system. So the analogy that I heard was if someone said that this AI system is going to be used to say to destroy the Democratic Party in the United States, and then you're going to like, this computer system is going to spit out a list of names of so-called Democratic Party operatives. It could be anyone who's ever voted for the Democratic Party, someone who's ever gone door knocking for a Democratic candidate, someone who's a local official in the smallest municipality, and so on and so forth. So basically, you're saying that literally anyone could be targeted. Yeah. I mean, people have been talking about, you mentioned 972 magazine, and they've revealed a lot of information. This is an Israeli leftist or leftish magazine, but they're calling it a flawed system. Like, in other words, this system is not working the way it should. Whereas the way I see it, and I want you to react to this, is that the system is working exactly as it's intended, because the purpose is not to actually identify so-called Hamas operatives, even members of the military wing, but to provide a justification for killing as many people as possible.
Yeah, look, I've seen also that. I mean, I can't really comment on... You know, yes, I mean, yeah, what 972 has said in various places. But, I mean, my view about this is that the AI systems, are, as you say, are working exactly as planned. And I've seen this existing before October 7 elsewhere in the world, where the whole rationale behind AI-enabled warfare that the US and Israel has made for years is pinpoint targeting. We're just going to go after the terrorists. We're not going to get civilians. So-called collateral damage, a term which I think is offensive beyond belief, will be minimized. It's all nonsense. Look at what's happening in Gaza, obviously. And I think it's also worth saying that the impact, though, of this kind of warfare, there's a story in Nikkei, the Asian news service, literally 2 weeks ago, which I wrote about, which found that, unsurprisingly, Israel is already promoting AI-enabled warfare to a global market. At arms fairs and elsewhere. In other words, it's working exactly as planned in Gaza. The aim is mass destruction. That is the point. And the thing that I keep coming back to over and over again, which the report doesn't talk about because it's not its mission, is all, I mean, this is sort of obvious to say this, but none of this causing mass destruction is making the life of Jews, let alone Israelis, so much more unsafe. It's just insanity. Like this idea somehow that when the US was fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was this geographical comfort. It wasn't next door. It wasn't Mexico. None of it justified what they were doing, of course, but it wasn't on their doorstep. The idea somehow at the end of this, whenever that happens, that Israelis, talking about Israeli Jews, are going to feel safer. I mean, you and maybe we obviously know that's obviously not the case, but that aspect of this conversation is so missing. It's absurd. I just find that lack of perspective, because of paranoia, because of revenge, because of bloodlust, because of the political atmosphere, because of racism, all the anti-Palestinianism which we know exists in Israel and much of the Jewish diaspora, sadly, not entirely anymore, but too much so. It's so counterproductive. So what worries me finally is that this justification for using AI to have a cleaner war, in fact, achieves the opposite. And just one final point on this. Of course, since 9/11, when the US was in Iraq and Afghanistan, they were often targeting people who had mobile phones, right? Person X had a mobile phone in Kabul, in Baghdad. They were seen as a terrorist. They were taken out. I'm hearing in Gaza exactly the same thing is happening. So this is part of AI, but also partly the idea that person X is seen to be a Hamas militant. Maybe let's argue that's possibly true, but they pass their phone to somebody else or they give it to their kid or they give it to their friend. Who knows? But that person therefore is targeted with dozens and dozens of civilians around.
And that's very common. I can tell you that it's very common even before this genocide that people buy and sell SIM cards.
Absolutely.
So,
you
know, you might have someone's number and then after a few months you call them and it's someone else completely who picks up that phone is no longer theirs. And of course, in this time of genocide, you know, working phones are at a premium. So people may be sharing phones. They may be selling, you know, they may be as a service letting people use phones for a little bit of money and so on. So all that is very well taken. And we know that that the phones are used to target people and to track people. And people consider them to be almost targeting devices because Israel can access the entire cell phone network.
Yes.
But I mean, just again, to look at the bigger picture here, because a lot of the reporting and the discussion of the AI has not surprisingly looked at the horrifying detail of this, the idea that computer programs are spitting out lists of names of people who are then being targeted, and not just them being targeted, because they say so-and-so who the computer program has identified as a so-called Hamas operative lives in this apartment building with 100 other people, and we're going to drop a 2,000-pound bomb on the apartment building. And that's what's been going on systematically. That's why there is so much destruction and so much killing in Gaza. But again, I want to just make the point about the bigger picture here, that all of this technical detail and horror can, in a sense, make us miss the forest for the trees, which is that after 6 months, Israel has achieved nothing in terms of its stated military goals. The unstated goal is killing and ethnic cleansing and revenge. But the stated goal is to destroy Hamas as a military and political organization and to bring back the Israeli prisoners of war and captives who are in Gaza, and they've achieved none of that. So again, do you think, I mean, it's one thing for hype and marketing for Israel to say, look at our brilliant technologies, but if you're in a defense ministry in a Western country and you're responsible for spending the money, aren't you going to look at this and say, well, I mean, it's a lot of hype?
It's a good question. Yeah, I've seen not much evidence of that yet. Again, the caveat is always yet. Everything you say is correct. I mean, completely correct. But again, when we talk, for example, just to go back to the Russia-Ukraine situation, all the European countries that were buying all that missile defense shield and other tech, I don't see any evidence they're going to stop buying it because of October 7 or the last 6 months, apart from the fact that most European states have supported Israel throughout the whole thing, as we know. I don't see any evidence that the Arab states that still rely on repressive tech, as I said before, will stop buying it. I don't see that. I don't see any evidence that they would. Now, you're absolutely right. The stated goals have been a catastrophe. Israel hasn't achieved any of them. It's hard to see how they will. But again, look at the analogy with the US post 9/11. Iraq and Afghanistan were a catastrophic failure and human rights catastrophe in every way. The American defense sector has never been more successful. It's had no impact whatsoever. In fact, it's had the opposite effect. Now, I'm not saying every analogy is perfect, but the fact that Israel is failing miserably on its own ambitions, to me, does not necessarily mean that the people who are spending money in Riyadh or Phnom Penh in Cambodia, where apparently there's increasing interest in many
countries. Or Helsinki
states.
Or Stockholm or The Hague or
Well, The Hague
Berlin.
Would be nice. Yes.
Well, yeah.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, look, I'm sure, look, anyone who's sensible will maybe have those conversations about saying, well, how effective is this technology? But, yeah, I mean, look, I've seen no evidence for it so far. I don't know what to say beyond that. And it's, on one level, it's bewildering. On the other hand, the mission often is mass destruction, and many other nations admire that Israel can do that. And one thing I should say, which I say in the book consistently, is many other nations for decades have often come to Israel and asked for advice how to get away with it. This is such a key point, right? Now, is Israel getting away with it in Gaza? Well, yes, of course they are. I mean, we could argue about global public opinion, the potential of sanctions. I agree with all that. But in terms of Israel hasn't stopped, we're 6 months in, they've killed, what, 40,000? We don't even know how many people have been killed. No one's stopping them, really, so far. And many other nations, including, I would argue, states that have been publicly appalled with what Israel is doing, will still end up buying some of those weapons and repressive tech. We all know that.
It's stunning, but no, that makes sense. It's like they see, you know, how destructive this kind of tech can be, even if it fails to protect the ones using it. Sometimes it's still, you know, the most it's a major global market product.
I should just say one thing. I mean, yeah. When I say that, people might think, that sounds, there's no silver lining. I think the last 6 months, though, have brought up, which obviously many people, with EI and others, have talked about arms embargoes for years. There will be some states that will try to impose some. I don't know who that will be. Maybe South Africa. It's not going to be America or the UK or Australia, of course, but some will. And some will. And that's something, in other words, I'm not saying every single country simply is blinded by the so-called brilliance of Israeli repressive tech. I don't think that. But I think you and I know that in the coming months and years, Israel will try and spend huge amounts of money to sell how, inverted commas, effective their repressive tech has been.
Right.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I think it's worth mentioning that just last week, the UN Human Rights Council voted by 28-6 to call for an arms embargo on
Absolutely.
Israel. And of course, there's no surprise as to who the handful of no votes were. There were some abstentions, but the handful of no votes, not surprisingly, included the United States and Germany. The abstentions also included the Netherlands and France and other close allies of Israel. But we've seen other countries, for example, a court in the Netherlands ordered that country to stop shipping spare parts to Israel. Yeah. And of course, we just in recent days, we saw the International Court of Justice hearing the case of Nicaragua versus Germany. And one of the demands of Germany is, one of the demands of Nicaragua is that the court order Germany to stop shipping arms to Israel. Of course, we're talking about Israeli arms exports, but I think it's important to remember that the arms trade goes in both directions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, then without American, and most people don't know this, maybe they do, your audience, but Germany is the second biggest arms provider to Israel, and they've sent massive amounts of arms, even in the last 6 months. People often don't know that, but it's huge.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, your point about, is Israeli tech is going to keep being on the world market unless it is stopped by arms embargoes. And I mean, it's just, and also I think about the way that, that AI is in this, you know, Israel is trying to kind of, massage AI and saying, well, you know, when the computer gives us these, you know, kill lists, then, and then it, you know, enacts, these killings on people that it has identified, then Israel is trying to absolve itself as the human military. Is this something that international law seems meaningless sometimes in cases like these, but does AI exist in a realm that is kind of a gray area for international law, when Israel is finally tried at The Hague for the genocide that is, that it has been orchestrating? Like, where does AI fit into that? And do you think that could contribute to something like, you know, a kind of a global shift in how weapons companies are using this technology.
Many international law experts that I've spoke to about this, not just in the last 6 months, but before, have said that at the moment, at least, there is a degree of gray area, not because international law supports mass killing of people.
Yeah.
But and this has come up an issue in the past years around even spyware, which is a far less destructive weapon, or even drones. When was the last time you saw a major American drone pilot put before the Hague? Never. And obviously there's been drone killings in Iraq and Afghanistan, elsewhere, and Syria.
But we've never seen a conventional American pilot put before the Hague either.
Indeed. Anyone. Completely. Absolutely. Yeah. Anyone. For sure. I mean, to me, there is a... And I've seen some attempts to accelerate the conversation around almost updating international law to accommodate. And ultimately, there's a human behind this system. Of course there is, more than one person. There's a whole team of people that obviously are feeding in the information, that information is coming from somewhere. Information is coming, for example, from whether it's Pine Gap in the center of Australia or American warships in the Mediterranean. So at the moment, there are a number of international lawyers that I know that are trying to push the UN and others to accelerate almost the drafting to update laws because of what we're seeing in Israel and Gaza, because the fear always is that this proves, inverted commas, proves the point that if Israel gets away with that, the mass killing in Gaza, which is not just through AI, of course, but partially, then other states inevitably will follow, as they will. I don't know which ones will, but I could imagine there are various other states that I'm hearing that have expressed real interest in a massively sophisticated system that in some ways, I mean, depends what you define as massively sophisticated. I mean, it's a mass killing machine, essentially, under the guise of automation, but automated killing, which has a lot of appeal. And you're seeing that more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that there are some things that worry me about this. I mean, apart from the obvious things. I mean, for example, Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, reacted to some of the reports coming out about how Israel is using these AI, artificial intelligence systems, to compile lists of targets that, you know, is apparently there's no intelligence in it. It's pretty much indiscriminate. It's like taking the phone book. We don't have phone books really anymore. But
I remember. I'm old enough to remember phone books.
Those of us old enough to remember the phone book. It's like saying, here's the phone book, and that's your list of targets. Ultimately, that's what it amounts to. There's very little intelligent about it. Yeah. But what Antonio Guterres said, and I'm quoting here, he says, I've warned for many years of the dangers of weaponization of artificial intelligence and reducing the essential role of human agency. AI should be used as a force for good to benefit the world, not to contribute to waging war on an industrial level, blurring accountability. And I worry about that statements like that, Anthony, because there Guterres appears to be expressing concern about the artificial intelligence. But what he's saying, in a sense, is we won't be able to tell who did the crime. But to me, it's no less obvious who did the crime. Israel did the crime. Its leaders did the crime. Anyone who was involved in designing or operating this system did the crime. And I'm going to make an analogy that I make no apology for making, but this artificial intelligence is similar to a death camp in the sense that, you know, those who are responsible include everyone from those who give the orders to those who manufacture the poison gases or the machinery or who drive the trains and so on. The idea that, I mean, we've got Germany still putting on trial 95-year-olds who were secretaries in, you know, when they were 18 years old. In the 1940s, Nazi in Nazi Germany, and saying they're just as culpable as the person who gave the order at the top. And so if Germany has no trouble saying that a secretary who was 17 years old and who was a typist for some Nazi official should be put on trial in 2022 or 2023 or whenever the most recent trial was. I have no trouble saying that anyone involved in this so-called artificial intelligence killing machine is just as guilty. And I don't share Guterres's concern. They're all guilty. No problem there. But the other question that I have about this, Anthony, is that as we've noticed, some of the reports that have come out about this, some of the most detailed reports have come out in Israeli publications, which are subject to military censorship. Yeah. And so the question then is, why does Israel want us to know about these artificial intelligence systems?
In some of the interviews, Yuval Abraham, who I don't know personally, but he's the journalist who's written some of these stories, he's based, I think, in Israel somewhere, has said there's certain things I can't say or write about because I am subject to Israeli censorship, essentially, military censorship. Now, I don't know exactly what that is because he can't talk about it. Look, the question of why is this stuff coming out just or principally in the Israeli, although sort of quasi-alternative press, is an interesting question. I mean, I have my theories. I don't know. I mean, I think there are, you could argue it's not dissimilar in a way to how during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, various dissidents within the Defense Department or soldiers would go even to the most mainstream journalists in the New York Times. New York Times obviously has blood on its hands from Iraq and God knows how many wars for decades, and yet for a range of reasons wanted to get the audience. I mean, you could say the same about WikiLeaks back in the day when Julian Assange was partnering with the New York Times and others. He wasn't a fan of the New York Times or the Guardian or other papers that he was partnering with, but it was to reach the audience. Now, 972 is hardly the New York Times. That's true. It's a relatively small outlet that would get a big audience. Whether we should see that cynically, I don't know. I mean, Or maybe it's an attempt by certain Israeli intelligence officials to try to absolve themselves of responsibility and to sort of launder their image. You know, we're the good guys inside trying to keep the system honest. Maybe.
Yeah, the timing is also pretty interesting. Mm. Anthony, I wanted to finally, we just have a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about activism inside Australia, where you are. And, in terms of discussing the arms embargo, how Australians are trying to pressure their lawmakers to, respect international law, to abide by the responsibilities toward the Palestinian people, and to stop being involved in the weapons trade with Israel. What's going on there?
Well, Australia, unsurprisingly, has been a pretty strong supporter of Israel from the beginning, has been for decades, really.
Yeah.
And like we mentioned before, that case in the Netherlands a few months ago where there was an attempt successfully to stop the government sending key parts to Israel. Australia has exactly the same situation. It hasn't been a successful court case, but Australia also is a key part of the global supply chain that we, when I say we, not me, we as a country are sending key parts to Israel, have for years and have been doing, from my understanding, since October 7 as well. There is a growing movement here of trying to stop Israeli shipping companies that are docking in Australia. People may have seen that online. There is a growing sense that in certain key, we have an election here in about a year. When there is an election here in certain seats that are held by the Labor Party, which is the party in power here, there is profound anger around Labor support for Israel. And I think it's not dissimilar to what we're seeing in certain states in the US with the Democrats, that people are saying, we're not supporting Trump in November, but we're not going to vote for Biden over my dead body because of what's happening in Gaza. Something similar is happening here. And although the election is still a year away, I think that's important to say, there has been massive amounts of protests. I mean, the last 6 months, often there are 50,000, 100,000 people on the streets protesting. not every week. It's obviously less than it was, but there is protests on the street still every week, mostly Sydney, Melbourne, but also others, the two big cities. I think what has happened here, which I see in other countries around the world, is beyond people who normally have understanding about Palestine, it has massively expanded people's awareness of what is happening to people who aren't necessarily involved in the past, people who might necessarily have spoken out in the past, people who might not go to a protest in the past, whatever that looks like. And for a lot of people that I speak to, and these are people who write to me a lot, including a lot of people in the Jewish community, by the way, and the issues in the Jewish community which are happening in America, although America is a much more visible example of that increasing generational split that we see, is happening here too, thankfully. And yes, the mainstream major Jewish organizations are 110% behind Israel. That is true. But there are growing numbers of especially young Jews who are speaking out publicly. They have growing numbers of organizations that get media coverage, that get traction, that are being heard. It's mostly younger Jews, though not all. So the picture of Australia in some ways is not dissimilar, I'd say, to other Western states, where we have a nation which is very supportive of Israel, has been for years. But it's increasingly politically problematic for the government to do so, even though there's bipartisan support in the country for it. Like in your country, the Republicans are even madly more pro-Israel than the Democrats. Australia, our opposition party, is the same. But in terms of public opinion polls, has been massive. There's been majority support for a ceasefire for months. Just finally, there was a poll this week in the UK, which I saw and I knew would be repeated here. There was a poll in the UK, you may guys have seen that this week, which showed that the majority of British people, yes, supported a ceasefire, but also supported both an arms embargo and Britain no longer sending weapons to Israel. There was a story in The Guardian about it a few days ago. I'm positive that a similar case would exist here if that poll was taken. Now, that would not have happened on October the 6th, and that's significant.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The tide has turned in so many places for so many people. Our lawmakers are the ones who won't until they're forced to, which...
Until they're forced to.
Yeah, that's it. Anthony Lowenstein, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream. Again, your book is called The Palestine Laboratory, we'll put up a link to the podcast that we did, I think it was last June, which seems like it was 100 years ago.
It seems like we haven't aged at all, Nora, but yes,
no, not at all.
It was a while ago.
We're doing great. People can go back and watch that really wonderful interview we did about your book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Yes, thank you again, Anthony and Ali. That was a really good interview. So much information about just very bleak, but also hopeful.
Yeah, and you know, as I was listening to that, because of course we talked to Anthony earlier because we didn't want to wake him up at 2 a.m. in Australia. But as I was listening to that again, I was remembering how, you know, Israel sells all these technologies. And it's not just, of course, military technologies, but also so-called policing technologies.
Yeah.
So these kinds of AI systems that are being used to commit genocide and mass murder will almost certainly appear in American cities in the hands of police departments.
Yeah.
And actually, I was communicating earlier, some of you may remember, we had Paul Bigar on a couple of months ago who is a tech entrepreneur and CEO, and he talked to us about the role of tech in this genocide. And he messaged me and he said that this is like, there's an element of pre-crime to it, or that mm-hmm. movie Minority Report,
yeah,
which is set in a dystopian future where mm-hmm. they can identify and punish people before they commit a crime.
I think it was actually a Philip K. Dick novel before it was
a movie. So I think that that's important to keep an eye on, that these technologies will likely be introduced in our cities, in our communities, through the pretext of policing, particularly in the U.S. context. Already these AI systems exist that are being used supposedly to stop gang violence. So more control, and a lot of it comes from Israel.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that we had Anthony on. You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Adi Abunima, and let's bring on our colleague, John. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Good show.
Hi, John.
Yeah. You're going to detail the complex resistance ambush that chased the military out of Khan Yunis over the last few days. And you're also going to show us a video about Hezbollah's downing of Israel's flagship drone over Lebanon and what that could mean regionally. John, take it away.
Yeah, it dovetails well with the Anthony interview.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, so the Qassam Brigades released a video yesterday. So did Soraya Al-Quds, just in time for our show. Kept me busy for the last 24 hours. But let's just start with the first one, Tamara, because we're going to just set the context here. We've been 6 months of this war. Qassam put out a video the other day here that we're showing you, that just shows, if people remember back to all these videos we've shown over the last several months, Qassam put out a sort of best of here, showing us all the different weapons, tactics that they've used in the war, showing us the incredible bravery, of course, but also the tactical efficacy. We see here tanks being dragged away. And we know that each of these videos represents a much larger operation that we don't see on these videos. These videos are tight cropped. I'm sure after the war, we'll see more of the detail of these operations. But in general, the edits are usually very tight, especially on the Qassam Brigade's videos. But the operation that happened on the weekend, we can maybe start with that now, Tamara. Number four. So they're showing us all the steps of this operation. What we're looking at here is the fighters getting, these are the commanders. We can see some details in this as they're planning this this ambush. They called it the ambush of the righteous in the Al-Zana area of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza on the eastern edge of Khan Yunis. And we see the fighters here talking, and we're looking at images of this, and you can see the tablet in front of the map that they're working on there, showing an aerial drone footage of the area. And these fighters are planning this detailed ambush. You can see the phone beside them suggesting that this is a tunnel operation, that this is being planned inside the tunnel. So the second time around, he says the infantry force will return to here. He's pointing out all of these directions. He's pointing to the setting of the ambush. He's talking about two shooters meeting at this particular point. And then the interesting part about this, I mean, there's many interesting parts about this, but these fighters clearly have intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance to such a degree here that they're predicting the troop movements of the IDF after this attack, after the initial ambush. And they're talking to each other about where to set each of these devices, because it's a multi-layered ambush that involves shooters. It involves soldiers then fleeing to what they believe is a safe house. And then these commanders here are talking about setting up devices to booby trap the safe house, picking the particular devices here. They're talking in detail about which devices to use. We know we've talked for several months about the Qassam Brigade's use of the Shawaz explosively formed penetrators. This is a series of weapons that are used against tanks and armored vehicles, but also have anti-personnel versions of these weapons. And so they're detailing exactly where to put each of these devices in this complex ambush because based on the movements of the troops. And so I'll give you just on the next time through, I'll give you the dialogue because the dialogue is remarkable. And again, this operation happened on Saturday. So he says the infantry force will return after they finish their work, saying that they'll go back home to the tunnel safely. This is not a martyrdom operation. He's saying here, set up the anti-personnel devices here, set up the anti-armor devices here. And then he says the armored vehicles will come to rescue the soldiers, and they'll come from this location, from the artillery position. So they're pointing out at this point, now 4 months into the operation, into the war on Khan Yunis, they have surveillance and reconnaissance and intelligence enough to be able to dictate what position will move from the border, which they're calling the artillery position. The tanks are on the border in the buffer zone shelling into the cities, and that's this ruining Khan Yunis, destroying Khan Yunis in the way that Nora ably covered as usual in the news report at the beginning of this show. Khan Yunis is just absolutely devastated. And so those artillery positions that they're referring to here are those tanks on the border. So they're able to, Qassam told Al Jazeera Arabic that this was a 50-day operation in planning, something that we've talked about on this show for many months now. The longer the Israelis are in these areas in Gaza, the more likely these large-scale attacks are able to be planned in this kind of detail. And so you see that the fighters here talking, and he says, let's review the troop leading procedures, which is a military term for preparing your unit for a mission, which is an interesting little tidbit in this, because we know that Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, said that Hamas is no longer functioning as a military organization. Just that little detail in this shows us that these aren't the people taking part in the operation. These are the commanders setting the operation, and then they will give that operation to their units to execute them in a functioning military organization, which we've been monitoring here on the show for this entire war, because there's two stages of the Qassam Brigades. There's the national army of the Qassam Brigades, but if the national army were to be dismantled as Israel promised, they would move into fighting as a guerrilla organization. And we've been watching closely for that as a sign of tracking the war. And we've never seen any detail that suggests that they're dismantled in any way as a military organization in any of the areas that Israel has been fighting in throughout this war. And this battle in Khan Yunis started in the beginning of December. So this is a 4 full-month battle here, and you're seeing on video evidence of the Qassam Brigades operating as a military organization. You can see that they clearly have, they're able to get the intelligence from that. You can see the tablet there with the drone footage of that. So they're able to carry out these kind of sophisticated operations that require precision, accuracy, and acumen because they have because they're continuing to function as a military organization, despite the brutality brought down, just the appalling crimes brought down on the civilians of Gaza. We haven't seen any evidence of any kind of even marginal military successes from Israel. So this operation is on Saturday, the day before the Israelis left Khan Yunis. And this video will give you a real sense of why it is that the Israelis left Khan Yunis. And again, so Qassam told us about this operation on Saturday. They noted that it was the 27th day of Ramadan, which is Laylat al-Qadr, which is the night of power. It's one of the holiest days on the Muslim calendar. We can see the fighter here holding the miswak, which is a dental health branch that the prophet used. And so they're really in this video tapping into the fighting tradition and to Ramadan, and are able to, because of that date, indicating that they're able to pick the date to execute this operation. These are not happening. And as I said, this is a 50-day operation in planning, and then they're able to execute it on this very meaningful day, very significant day on the Muslim calendar. They're able to execute this operation, which this video has a number. It's very, the core of the video is related to Laylat al-Qadr, and that's actually been unique in Qassam's videos. They haven't focused on the religious elements in their videos much at all. And so this was an interesting video to see that, because they, of course, are tying it into a long history of struggle, and are also suggesting they're able to pick the days in a way that's really remarkable. Again, you can see the phone lines for the internal communication system that Israel hasn't been able to get at, that connects to the tunnel apparatus. And one interesting element of this video is that this is clearly a tunnel operation. It's able to be taken place because of the tunnel networks. But that shows up almost not at all in this video by Qassam. The tunnel network is considered to be just part of the military project. They're not trying to highlight or show off that element of it, which from, we'll see later, from the Israeli perspective, was this was one of the singular reasons for the success of the operation. So just interesting to note that. And we'll go to number five when these guys finish here tomorrow. And now we see them outside. This is all the same video. I cut it up for you here to show you. So after after briefing their units, the fighters, we see them here moving through. And if you look at the landscape, you can see it's just scorched earth, completely demolished. Israel believes that they hold this area completely. They identified that it was on a logistics supply route, which indicates to the Israelis that they believe it's a safe road, that after all of this time, these many months of fighting in Khan Yunis, that they believed that this area was safe. And that is one of the reasons why Qassam was able to carry out this operation, because of the 50-day planning, because of the patience and surveillance. And so we see the fighters here. That fighter, first fighter, is holding an anti-personnel device, and he's going to place it in a particular, aim it at a particular direction, which is what we saw in the planning video. That fighter there is holding a Shawaz. He's going to take it out to the roadside. You can see him go out to the roadside to plan it. That's another anti-personnel device here. The fighter's going here. We're watching him walk through the rubble. Just unbelievable destruction, criminal destruction of the civilian city of Khan Yunis here. But we're seeing these fighters out on the road planting particular devices on the road that are different than the devices that they're booby-trapping this building with. And then they're aiming the particular devices, which we saw in the planning meeting. They're not just an improvised explosive device that just goes off in a general area. These are anti-personnel devices designed to be aimed. And so the fighters are putting this, laying this ambush with such detail that they're aiming these weapons in the place of a predictive move by the Israeli army, that they will flee this, flee the initial ambush, and they will flee to this safe house. And they picked which safe house they believed the Israelis would run to. And they wire up that safe house. They wire up the road on the outside with a Shawaz for the tanks, because as they said in the planning meeting, there will be a stage where they will come to rescue, the Israelis will come to rescue their soldiers hit in the ambush, and they will come in armored vehicles down this road. In the planning meeting, the general says to place the Shawaz on the roadside, but he also says we need multiple Yassin shooters to fire RPGs at the tank that's entering from a particular direction. You can see that this is a four-way intersection, and the Israelis have thousands of troops and dozens of armored vehicles and tanks, scores of them, that could respond But the Qassam brigades have identified which ones actually will. So you see the fighters wiring these devices, in particular, setting the ambush. And this is something that Qassam hasn't really showed us a lot of. The pre video that we see the video, we don't generally see Qassam doing this work, the fighters laying the devices ahead of time. And so that's something in this video. This video was an 8-minute long video that people can find on my Twitter after the show if you haven't seen it yet in its entirety. This is, again, I've chopped this up, and also for the censorship reasons that everybody, I think, that watches this show is aware of, we skate a line with these edits to try to keep these videos up, because a lot of the best videos over the course of this war have been taken down through censorship. But the Qassam brigades have within their fighting units these media operations arms, and having these videos be disseminated and showing the actual battle on the ground is a critical point that we've stressed all throughout this war, of the way that Qassam's media operations work amid the avalanche of lies that the Israelis tell, and the cover-up of the military successes of the resistance. These videos have been the antidote to those lies. So significant detail that we're seeing in these operations. So maybe we could go to number 6 tomorrow. So this is the ambush itself. You can see here, this is a unit. Qassam says this is a unit of 30 soldiers. This is part of the commando brigade of the Israeli army. This is the only indication in the video. That darkness right there is the only indication that this is a tunnel operation. But it's actually the key part of this operation is that they're accessing this destroyed building, and you can see the landscape. So Israel believes through its constant aerial surveillance that they have this entire area held. But the fighters are able to come up in a tunnel in a destroyed house, something that we talked about on the 9th of October would happen in a ground operation. So they're able to use the tunnel network to come up inside a demolished house that the Israelis believe is no longer a threat. And you can see in this video, these are the soldiers walking into the ambush, into the booby trap. So Qassam has hung, we have seen already just in these three videos, at least 6 cameras that are hung. And we know cameras, that cameramen are not just on these hung cameras. And Qassam said there's much more video of this operation. So you can see this unit here, this soldier is carrying flagging markings, which has a red triangle on it. I'm not sure if he intended that to be the case, but we see the fighters coming up through the tunnel here. You see their weaponry, and the two shooters are getting in position for the ambush here. We're watching the fighters move into position. Now we're watching video cameras, CCTV camera footage of the Israelis on patrol, walking into the ambush that's set up, and then they flee. We've cut this part out, but there's many soldiers in this operation that we see, many casualties that we see, and then we see the soldiers flee that initial shooting that has just been edited out, and then they're approaching here the building they believe is the safe house that we watch the fighters rig up the anti-personnel devices in, and then they detonate in that. And the Israelis have said that 4 soldiers were killed in this operation. Qassam said that there was 10. They're identifying 10 killed in this video. Again, we don't know. The Israeli numbers don't ever add up. It definitely appears very consistently that they are covering up their mass casualty events, but we are seeing the soldiers walk into the ambush here in this video. Again, you can see the scorched earth. Israel has destroyed all the buildings in this area, and these soldiers have probably been walking this route for days as part of a patrol to guard their resupply route, which is the most available target. The resupply is the most available target. Because the soldiers constantly need that resupply. And so the soldiers walk into the Shawaz here, And this goes off, the device goes off in the place. So Qassam picked the building to be that they knew the Israelis would take shelter in and then detonate inside that building. So maybe we can skip to number 7 here, Tamar. There's the guy with his flag. Just to skip to number 7 here, we're seeing, now we're seeing the rescue, just as Qassam predicted. The rescue's coming, the tanks racing down the road here, and we see the cameraman facing the barrel of the tank, which is something that we constantly see. And we see a direct hit Yassin strike from an elevated firing position, hits the turret of the tank, and the tank slowly drifts off the road, which is something we haven't seen before, but it's clear in this video that the tank drifts off to the side of the road after being hit. And then the second, just as Qassam predicted, the second tank approaches to cover it. And again, you can see in this video an elevated Yassin strike. So they're using the upper floors of a destroyed building to hit that tank. Israel acknowledged both of those tanks being hit. This is the third one tank that we're seeing here hit with the Shawaz device that we saw being planted in the booby trap section of the video. So this is the Yassin 105 strikes. This is, again, just to reiterate, Qassam built weapon. It's a Soviet clone, but it's something that the Qassam brigades built themselves in Gaza and have provided all of their fighters throughout the war, despite the fact that there's been 4 months of concentrated attack on Khan Yunis. They're still able to bring out all of the weapons that are the most appropriate for the operation. So we see both of those tanks get hit, and then a third tank hit with the Shawaz. That tank that drifted off the road hasn't corrected its position. It's still drifted off the road, suggesting that Yassin strike penetrated the vehicle, which we know also happens. The Israelis acknowledge casualties from their armored units. Now we cut out the main part of the ambush again for YouTube reasons. But yeah, so maybe we could go to just as proof, we could go to number 9 here, Tamara. Number 9 shows us here. We can see up in the top left corner there a D9 armored bulldozer pulling the wreckage of that tank away from that site. And so just maybe we can go back through each of the videos from 5 to from 5 to 9 tomorrow, because I just want to, while we do that, I'm going to just tell you what the Israelis said happened in this operation, and people can judge for themselves if the Israelis are telling the truth about these operations. The Israeli internal probe suggested that, this is what the Israeli the IDF reported this. 4 were killed on Saturday when gunmen came out of a tunnel in a destroyed building and opened fire at troops carrying out a patrol along the IDF's logistics route in Khan Yunis, according to the initial military probe. The operatives apparently managed to flee back into the tunnel. So again, we're seeing fighters return back to their base. These are not martyrdom. These are not martyrdom missions. If we could skip, Tamara, could we skip to number 6? Because I want to just show you what the Israelis said happened in number 6. The Israelis said the soldiers who tried to pursue the attackers noticed that the escape route was booby-trapped and therefore held back. And it's clear in this video that we're watching that the booby trap went off on the soldiers that fled. So we have the initial ambush, which is a shooting ambush. We see the two shooters there. We see the soldiers here approaching the ambush, and we're going to cut out the part where the soldiers fall. But the soldiers are ambushed here, and then the following group of soldiers turns and runs to what they believe is the safe house. You can see the soldiers moving there. They're wounded, and then here they are approaching the safe house. This is the camera on the safe house. You can see them virtually running, as close to running as you can get over that rubble, and then the device is detonated on this troop, which that camera clearly shows. So you can just see by the Israeli detail the lies that we have been trying to filter and trying to find the signal in the noise of all of this propaganda and cover-ups that the Israelis do. But this operation was said by Qassam on Saturday. They announced it in a field report that this operation happened. And the Israelis acknowledged an operation. They didn't say where. They just said in the south, where four soldiers were killed along a logistics route, and that the attackers fled back into the tunnel. But we clearly see here a much more sophisticated operation and a much more costly operation for Israeli forces. Because we'll remember that the reason, so this is Saturday, this operation. By sunup Sunday, the Israelis are gone. And within minutes of that, people are going back to Khan Yunis, to their homes, which Nora talked about. People went immediately back to their homes. So people were in their homes, or what's left of their homes. In most cases, no, their homes didn't exist anymore. But they were back on Sunday, within 24 hours of this operation that we're seeing. Some reports on the area talked about three medevac helicopters, part of the 1,500 that the Israelis have flown during this operation, removing their troops. And so you can clearly see by this one example, which Qassam has dropped on the most important day of the Muslim calendar, after 6 months of battle, at a time when Israel is saying they've dismantled Hamas as a military organization and are withdrawing from Khan Yunis. And on Sunday, people are trying to think of the reasons why the Israelis withdrew from Khan Yunis. And what we're seeing in this video is pretty clearly the reason why. The Israelis stayed in Khan Yunis for the last operations that Israel carried out before withdrawing from Khan Yunis was, of course, the attack on Nasser Hospital. They wanted to dismantle the second largest hospital after Shifa, where the weeks before they were carrying out a brutal raid at Shifa to dismantle it. And we know that they also carried out an operation at Al-Amal, the Red Crescent Hospital in Khan Yunis, where they dismantled the hospital, told everybody they dismantled the hospital, and then bulldozed sand berms around the hospital so that people couldn't enter the hospital. And so in order to stay for those extra 2 weeks to carry out those brutal massacres and dismantling of the healthcare system, the Israelis left themselves in a position that they were subject to this attack by Qassam, a very costly attack. And we know from the show last week, I covered the attack on Nasser Hospital, where the Israelis went back into Nasser to dismantle it. And a troop of their special forces, AGOS, guerrilla warfare unit, was hit by a thermobaric warhead that we covered last week, with 16 casualties in that operation. So the Israelis are losing dozens of soldiers in order to remain in hospitals, in order to remain dismantling hospitals, and the Palestinian resistance is able to, after all of this time, carry out what is, I would say, the most amazing video that we've seen of this war, the complexity, the detail, and then the exact precision, the predictive nature of it, to predict which way the Israeli movements were going to come. All of that is remarkable military organization that just clearly puts lie to everything that we read. It, unfortunately, in the Western and English language media about this war. And it wasn't just this Qassam operation. There was also Saraya al-Quds operations in Khan Yunis. So we could go to 0A here tomorrow. I had to number these weird because these all came out yesterday right before as we were planning for this show. And so you see Saraya al-Quds again, Islamic Jihad's armed wing. You see a fighter hooking up an explosively formed penetrator. This video kind of has everything of this war. We see him walking through the walls, which is something that Palestinians have done effectively throughout this war, to move ably through buildings, through mouse holes that they've created, and to fight in the alleys. And here we're looking at a cameraman that's showing an Israeli tank within one block We see the Israeli tank here pulling into the intersection, his barrel pointed directly at the cameraman, something that we repeatedly see pointed at the fighters or at the cameraman. And we're going to watch there. The fighter pops out of the alley, fires his RPG with a tandem 85 warhead, which is a uniquely Gazan creation, to add the second explosive charge to a weapon that wasn't as effective anymore because of the up-armoring of Israeli armored vehicles. And so we're seeing them use a tandem 85 here. He fires that at the Israeli troop position that's in a building behind the tank. The tank is covering the troops in the building. So the fighter pops out of the alley. First of all, the cameraman is just right there in the streets. That's incredible courage. And then you see the fighter pop out of the alley, fire on the troop position, not on the tank. He fires it over the tank and then detonates. That's where we're seeing the device detonated on the tank, a much more impactful weapon to use against the armored vehicle than the RPG. And so the RPG fire is a decoy at the troops. As their attention is taken away, the Shawaz that we're seeing here now, the device is detonated, that was pre-positioned. Again, a predictive operation, assuming where the Israeli troop movements would go, because the Palestinian resistance has intelligence and reconnaissance in all of these areas. We're seeing fighters moving. We're seeing 6 months on, 5 months of ground war. These fighters are skilled fighters. They're battle tested. The drones that Ali and Nora and Anthony talked about at the beginning as battle tested, as machines, doesn't mean anything in comparison to the battle testing of this entire generation now of Gaza militants, who you can see just moving through, firing and getting back into the alleys, which is something that we've seen throughout this war.
Welcome back. And that was Electronic Intifada discussing the ongoing military campaign taking place in Gaza. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. And that is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Hank Mobley, Mobley's Message from 1956. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you.